Hey everyone, Norm here. Before we start, I want to let you know that this week's episode of This Is Only a Test is made possible with support from Storyblocks. Storyblocks is the world's best stock media service offering video, audio, and images with the most affordable subscription plans on the market. Their ever-growing library has over 1 million high-quality and, importantly, royalty-free assets so you can bring your content to life more quickly and efficiently than ever before. With Storyblocks' unlimited all-access plan, you get unlimited downloads of everything in the library so you can try out multiple options and find the perfect fit for whatever you're making. My recommendation is try it out. Download as many of the assets, help make your video content look different, and level it up with these awesome assets. And then if you decide not to continue, you still get to use those assets. They're royalty free. Learn more and subscribe today at storyblocks.com/onlyatest. That's storyblocks.com/onlyatest. Now back to the show.
Hey, let's start the show.
For Thursday, September 10th, 2020. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. All right. Not bad. Pretty good, even. Thank you, Jeff Anderson, for creating that theme music for us this week. We are still cycling through listener submissions for the ever ongoing search for a new piece of music. But that was it for this week. Well done, Jeff Anderson. I'm Norm. Thanks for joining us for a late podcast recording this week. You might be listening to this late Thursday, maybe even early Friday. But with me is Kishore Hari.
Hello.
Looking very orange.
I'm just trying to match like the ambiance of the western half of the United States right now.
We'll get to that. And sitting in for Jeremy Williams, we have a returning guest, first time in a long while. Great to see you. It's Trace Dominguez.
Hello. I was sad that Jeremy couldn't make it, but I'm happy that I could come back and say hi.
We're very happy as well. Jeremy will, of course, be back next week where we're going to talk all sorts of VR because Facebook Connect is happening. But it sucks for him because there's so much to talk about this week. And I'm glad you guys are both on because there's some Star Trek I definitely want to talk about with you guys. But let's do a little bit of catch up. How are things going? Trace, we haven't seen you since you moved to the Los Angeles area.
That's right. Yeah, I moved right before the whole pandemic started, so I haven't really explored LA much because I've been
to the sidewalk, the backyard.
I walked to the beach a few times. San Francisco's very walkable. I don't think I walked around my neighborhood just to walk around my neighborhood as much as I have here since moving. So we moved in February, and we've been inside pretty much ever since. But it's been nice otherwise. We have more room and the weather is nice and, you know, the sun is shining.
Though? Is it really? Is it okay though?
Yeah. It's okay. It's fine.
Maybe. But otherwise, you're still producing content, running your YouTube channel.
Channel, Uno Dose of Trace. I'm doing series of videos at least once a month about topics. The most recent one was about time. The one before that was about brain-computer interfaces, which I think we're going to come back to in a little bit.
I want to shout out the time one. You did an interview with Katie Mack, who's a astrophysicist that kind of studies like how the universe is going to end, you know, uplifting topic, but it just has a book out on it. And I thought that was a great interview.
Heat death.
Yeah.
There's more than one option than heat death.
Katie's got, she's awesome. The book is really good. It's called The End of Everything. And I was really lucky to get her to hop on and we talked for a whole like hour and a half, but I only put maybe 25 minutes into it just because she was blowing my mind like every 5 minutes. It was great.
I love the balance of lighting you have for people watching the video. Trace is a wonderful studio setup. I'm sure setting up the studio was quite fun for you.
It was so fun. Actually, I mean, when I was in SF, I was in my living room because I didn't shoot videos that often. I wasn't doing this full time. You know, I still had a full-time job and Then when we move down here, I have this whole bedroom that's just for me. So I've got a nice teal orange balance. These are just IKEA lights in the bookshelves. So that's just the IKEA orange over there. And then I got this neon What If light from a video production. They were like, we don't need this light. Do you want it? And I'm like, yes, I do. And it came out perfectly.
Awesome. A little peek behind the scenes. A different perspective for when people watch your videos. You got four walls, right? You can shoot from any angle.
Yes, I do. I mean, this is a closet. So I've actually, I put the camera in the closet when I host an astronomy show called Stargazers on PBS. And so I have to put the camera in the closet, run two Zoom accounts, one for the producers in Florida, and then one for a different producer to like show me what I'm standing in front of. And then there's a green screen that pulls down on this side. So I've made the most of a like 12 by 12 little room.
Just like the editor, the live mix guy for the Democratic National Convention. You saw that photo, right?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to like see his setup. That looked amazing.
And to do it with shorts. I just feel like that's the victory condition.
It is, yeah. I hope they were like athleisure shorts too. I couldn't really tell from the photo. They might have been like, you know, nice maybe khaki shorts with a pleat, maybe just like one pleat. He seemed like a pleated guy. I don't know.
I thought he was more of like a cargo shorts kind of guy. that guy wears cargo shorts and socks with sandals, like no doubt.
Honestly, you're Emmy Award winning, you can rock that.
Yeah, go for it. That or like a utilikilt, you know, like a kilt with pockets.
Utilikilt is actually a really good transition to where what I was doing this weekend, which is I was at Virtual Dragon Con. And that's a weird thing to say. Like the kilt is a transition because there's like a whole set of people that wear kilts at Dragon Con. It's like really? Their thing. Yeah. And there's a subculture for everything. So I've been trying to go to as many online cons as I can, partially because I enjoy con culture. You know, it's not without its faults, but I think live events are in like a really tough position right now. So I'm trying to support as many as I can in the coming months in hopes that, you know, a number of them survive. Now, Dragon Con's a huge one. It's an annual cosplay pop culture festival in Atlanta, and usually like 80, 90,000 people go. So it's not in any danger of not coming back next year. But with something that big, something that's so beloved, and it's really a fan-run con, I was very curious to see how they would organize this, because most other cons, if you look back even to like San Diego, is like panel on YouTube, panel on YouTube, panel on YouTube, mm-hmm. call it a day. And Dragon Con did have a bunch of panels, but they still had like the fan-run panels, where it's like, we're going to have, I literally watched an hour science panel on the diet of Baby Yoda, like an hour on that one narrow topic.
And
like,
what did we learn? I need to know. Give me the
oh, so much like notes. There was so much about like teeth and like there's that whole scene where he like swallows a frog, but he swallows it whole, and like there's bones. So what kind of teeth structure must he have? Like the whole like coloration of skin, like what to maintain that green color. If we're assuming certain environments. So it was very complicated. But, you know, that's like the essence of Dragon Con, is kind of like very deep dives into esoteric stuff. And they pulled it off. It's not the same. You can't recreate cosplay virtually as much as they tried. They had masquerades that were really cute and adorable. You got to see some really impressive cosplay showcase, but it's just not the same as seeing it live. But they created a ton of programming. So I probably watched like another 10, 15 hours of panels, and it was about as satisfying as any con I've been to, because it wasn't just like celebrity panel and call it a day. It was actually very much like more my speed. And the whole thing like hinged on Discord, which was just like nothing that I really thought. So they built like a massive Discord space to mirror the con. So like they had different sort of hotel lobbies, just like at the con, that you would like sort of go to. And like the different fan tracks actually existed, like the Discord channels existed in those hotel lobbies. So you would interact with people that like I've randomly met over the years in kind of like the same location that I met them before. And it was actually really well done. So it actually was the first time I was like, somebody's actually used Discord to its full abilities, and people were able to watch panels together and kind of talk to each other through the voice interface. It was really great.
What would you call that? Is that a skeuomorphism? If you're mapping like the organizational structure of
like
chat
a real
rooms,
space,
essentially,
yeah,
to a physical space. What is the, yeah, that's strange. It's basically, it's Jurassic Park. It's Unix. I know this, mm-hmm, right? And you're basically navigating, right?
Hold on to your butts. Here we go.
Right.
I've been going to the online VidCon, and it's not quite the same, but like they also have been using Discord. It seems like Discord's really like, feels like Discord, Zoom, a few of these apps happen to exist already and did a lot of stuff for a small niche community. And now they're these massive, people have just glommed into them. And I wonder how they're feeling about it, honestly. You
know? Well, I'm sure they're happy.
They're happy for getting the user base, but like, still, yeah. Wow.
A lot of integrations, it's a very powerful platform. And, you know, especially for video gaming, it's basically replaced so many other kind of social media services and done very well. We use it all the time. There's a tested Discord, tested.gg. No, discord.gg/tested. That's right.
There you go.
Right. Yeah. VidCon, how is that the online stuff? I know Google, I might be getting ahead of ourselves, but they announced their Fundo thing. I think kind of in line with the VidCon. You guys heard about that?
I haven't heard about that. No.
It's their way of doing meetups with creators. So it's part of the Google, like they have a whole spin-off department that does just experimental projects, called Area 120. It's an incubator within Google, and this project spun out of that. But basically, it allows creators to host, just using a web platform, meetups, one-on-one meetups, group seminars, and like 30 people can buy tickets for a scheduled time, and get, you know, your typical meet and greet photo booth, or a structured lesson on something. And
that sounds so awesome.
And they take their cut.
It's pretty similar to what cons have been doing with like different pop culture celebrities, where you get like a, you know, couple exactly. minute meet and greet. Does it use like Duo or Meet as its like video service?
Completely
like, or is
web-based.
It using something else?
There's web-based for a user, and then I think the creators, it's either an app or a web-based PC, like just like YouTube. So it's using the YouTube backend, I believe.
They have a lot of that functionality in YouTube. I guess this would just build some structure on top of that same backend, like
and said. Payment processing, their cut, 20% cut, and all that. Fundo,
20%. Damn.
I know. Well, you know, if we're gonna get to the percentage cut when we get to Apple Fortnite and Epic, but you know, 20 is better than 30, I guess.
There's a lot of foreshadowing in this episode.
I also just peg everything to Patreon at like, what's it at, 11 or 12? So it just seems high in comparison.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Any shout outs from Dragon Con? Any folks, sure, that you're happy to see? You plan on going back next year?
Did you dress up?
So I'm in a Stonecutters cosplay group from The Simpsons, and the kind of silliest thing we did is I bought a cameo from Steve Guttenberg, so when we sing the song, like, he now sings along with us, that was the best investment I've made. But in a way it was sad, because like Dragon Con, ever since I've been going, which has been like five years now or so, I immediately am like, this place is home to me. Like, just being amongst that sea of fans. And so, hell yes, I'm back. As soon as it can be back. You know, who knows if next year it's going to be able to come back. I really hope so. But count me in. Because I don't think you can ever get away from, like, that in-person creative juice that comes from seeing people cosplay together. And that's the place where it really hits home for me.
Yeah. Can you disclose what does a cameo from Steve Guttenberg cost? I know John Oliver
did a bunch
of those.
So I got in before the John Oliver up pricing.
Oh, nice.
So I paid like $100 or so, and I think it's $175 now.
Got it.
Oh, good.
You get that Oliver surge pricing. I would do the same.
Yeah, same location by the pool.
I was like in his bedroom. Like, and like, you know what? I'll just say this, you know, Steve Gutenberg, apologies if I'm revealing too much. It was too fast how fast he got back to me. It's like, you know, when you like hit submit button on a website and you're like, okay, I'm sure I'll see this tomorrow or in a couple days. It was like, I went to the bathroom, came back, and it's like, your cameo is here. And it was like, too fast.
Highly engaged creator. I think that's the technical term. Yeah, he is on it. Wow, very cool. That's funny. All right. Yeah. Well, as always, after the catch up and banter, let's start with our top story.
Top story this week.
Trace, I know you're in LA, so you didn't get to enjoy this hopefully once in a many year occurrence, but the sky in the Bay Area yesterday was orange.
Yeah,
it was nuts. Cause sure, I mean, we didn't record this yesterday because we were all freaking out. You had to get out of this town for some fresh air. But what was it like when you woke up yesterday?
So it was. I'll explain it this way. When I woke up, it was the end of Total Recall. About an hour later, it was full Blade Runner 2049. Like really deep orange.
Yeah.
And then by 11 a.m., which is when it was full unsettling for me, it was like solar eclipse. It was dark. Like the street lights on my street had come on. All the cars that were driving had their lights on. And outside of like a very Stranger Things, you know, that creature in the distance kind of like glow in the distant sky, it was night at 11 a.m.
Yikes.
And so it was like deeply, deeply unsettling. I never expected it to be that unsettling, to be like, hey, it's 11 a.m. and it's dark outside. I thought I would just be like, oh, okay, and just like go back to work like it was no big deal. It like created an enormous amount of anxiety in me that's only continued into today, where like even as we're recording this, the AQI levels, the particulate matter that's dangerous to our health, is about as high as it's been this entire season here in SF. It's like over 200, which is what's considered unhealthy for any adult to be outside.
And it stayed that way. It even got darker. I think it did not get anywhere resembling a normal day all of yesterday, and it just eventually just got dark because the sun set. But we couldn't, at least where I was, even near, you know, a couple miles from the ocean, could not see the sun at all. And it was so surreal. Like you said, street lights went on, photos that we saw of people, you know, people did go outside. So people went up to Twin Peaks in San Francisco, and just, you could just see that people who took their drones up above the fog layer, it just looked like Blade Runner. It looked completely orange.
Yeah, there are a bunch of videos of that people set it to the music, and it was both cool and also I watched them and was really sad. It was just like, because it isn't computer generated color. This isn't color grading. It's just life. But Norm, you're closer to the ocean, so, and it was even like that there where you would potentially get like a sea breeze.
There was no getting away from it. Like you could not see the ocean. You could see clouds, and you could see like there's contrast. So it wasn't like a blanket of the monotone haze. So there was some, like, you know, you could see some structure up in the atmosphere, but it was still blanket dark and orange.
Wow. So what was eerie about it is it was safe to go out in terms of the smoke levels and the air quality levels, because it was this kind of weird confluence of science stuff where all this smoke from fires out by Yosemite had created this huge plume of ash, and it had actually gone westward, but it had gone westward really high in the atmosphere. And as it got over San Francisco, there was this fog marine layer that was below the smoke layer. And the combination of those two took the essentially white light from the sun and scattered it. And the wavelength that it scatters first is blue light. So all the blue light gets filtered out first. And so only the stuff towards the other end of the spectrum,
Longer waves.
the longer we got through. And so that's why we got this like orangish red, like a reddish kind of color. That was a combination of the, of kind of like a yellow orange kind of spectrum of colors coming down. And so it was like, in this weird way, it was this cool science thing that was happening real time. Also, like, I remember seeing the National Weather Service, like Western area say, yeah, this is what's happening. They kind of explained what was happening with the light scattering. And they're like, and we have no models to explain what happens next. Like, we don't know what's going to happen. Like, there's people who I know reported having ash rain down on their cars and in their areas, and it smelled the smoke. Other places where it was like it was totally fine outside. I had a few people reach out that are friends that have lived in Australia and up near Edmonton, where they had similar fires in the last year, and talked about, you know, very similar skies over their cities for a couple days.
Wow. Now, it was due to the fires, and of course the West Coast is on fire from just, it's the season of it, but it feels much worse this season than past seasons. You know, the thing that people are not talking about enough on the news is that this is climate change. Like, the fires are a result of, you know, the world's getting hotter.
Yeah. Yeah. And that right now, the August complex, I think they reported not long ago, August complex fire, it's the largest in California history at 470,000 acres or something. I mean, it's not going to get any better if we don't do something about it. Not just like fight the fire, but that's like trying to fight the fever. The fever is happening because there's an underlying condition, then this is just what we're seeing.
So, right, we shouldn't ignore what's happening in Oregon right now as we're recording this. 10% of the population of the state is under evacuation orders because of how much fire is raging there. But in a California context, over 3 million acres have burned, which is almost the amount that has burned in the past 3 years combined, and is by far the most that have burned in 1 year on record, as far back as records go. And in addition, though I would say there are some like early, not reliable records going back like 100 years that have like burn rates similar during railroad times, because railroads would cause forest fires as they would go along, sparks from trains. This is totally intense. It's a combination of three factors from every scientist I've talked to. One is we've had a very successful history of fire suppression since the 70s, where we've limited the number of fires, and that has built up an enormous amount of fuel in the soil. The increased temperatures in the Bay Area, so if you look at a town like Berkeley, just across from where we are, average temperatures in Berkeley over the past 5 years have gone up around 2 degrees from where they were, which has led to drying out of soils, which makes them more flammable. And then there's increased weather conditions that can lead to spontaneous fire starting. So with increased temperatures, we see a higher propensity for lightning strikes. So a paper came out in 2015 that looked at the Western US and what the potential was for increased lightning strikes. And it was up 12% due to increased weather activity associated to climate change. And combine all of those things, you get lightning strike fires just spread so quickly. Then you combine that with a pandemic where many fire crews in California actually use people from prisons, and they're much more limited because of the way the pandemic has hit those regions. And we have a kind of a confluence of a bunch of terrible things all at once. There's just no question that this is worse because of climate change.
Yeah, yeah. Strong correlation. And we understand there's a ton of like bad shit happening in the world right now that are distracting people. But, you know, the one really depressing thing is, you know, the kind of national reaction and response to the pandemic, which is, you know, a global catastrophe kind of at the time scale that we were, as people are supposed to understand, as opposed to when we're talking about climate change. If we cannot you know, if the inconvenience of staying indoors and staying and being, you know, and being cautious and wearing a mask is not enough to get people to save themselves for that type of thing, then it you know, it's the inconvenience of climate change happening is something I don't know. You know, it's very depressing to think about.
I feel like there are a number of threads tying these things together too. I mean, you mentioned like our response to the pandemic is, I think it's a great kind of analogy to how we look at climate change. It's like, yeah, for the first few weeks, for the first few months, people were like super into doing stuff to protect themselves from this pandemic and protect others. Then it became just too annoying to deal with. And so people slowly started to do more and more and more things outside and away from, and like start to ignore it more and more things. It's like, it's easy to get people to save water for a very short period of time. It's very hard to get people to save water for a prolonged period of time. And it reminds me of like Game of Thrones, right? Where there are several people in a society who are just like, winter's coming. The winter is coming, y'all. And there are people that will not like it and not be able to just do whatever they want like they could in the summer.
Thanks for bringing it back to pop culture, Trace.
You're very welcome.
When winter is coming? I can tell you when. After tomorrow.
Yeah, to spin it back somewhere positive really quickly is, but preparedness can deal with elements of both of what we're talking about with the pandemic and with these fires. Like the California state has been partnering with a lot of Native American groups that had been doing prescribed burns, kind of in what they're called cultural burns, for a long period of time. And I think we're going to actually see a lot of attention on prescribed burns to kind of cut down on the amount of fuel that's available in this understory in really specific areas, especially in ways that protect cities and homes from potential damage. Because the one thing that's come out, like one of my favorite state parks, Big Basin State Park, which is just north of Santa Cruz, burned. Like the entire park burned. But they went in a few days later. All the redwood trees that are there are still alive because they're adapted for millions of years. Like this is normal for
them. That's what they do. It's amazing.
Yeah, this is like their jam. So there has to be like some level of preparedness and work that goes in between these periods. So we're not just hopping crisis to crisis, that we do something in between. And there are stories of positive influences that have been made. It's just, we have to do that at scale.
Yeah. Collectively, we're just not very good at looking at the long view of it all.
Absolutely.
I think another thing, you know, to go back to the analogy of the pandemic, is that much like the pandemic, climate change is going to affect people disproportionately, whether it's geographically or socioeconomically. And it's as connected as we all are with technology and communications today, we still are very disconnected outside of our own bubbles and the people that we directly relate to. And so, you know, like the folks, even though we may have friends in Australia, they went through the fires. That was another big sign earlier this year about the effects of climate change. And again, our short-term memory doesn't remember that and didn't prepare us for this.
Yeah. And we had fires here in LA. I didn't live here then, but like fires here. And part of it is also, you know, the policies of building into what used to be wildlife preserve. So, I mean, if you're an environmentalist, there are so many places that you can go out and help when it comes to climate change. And also when it comes to policy around other things that you value, like if we want to protect more land and want to treat that land properly, like fire science and forestry science is still evolving all the time. So, you know, there's lots of stuff to learn.
Yeah. Unless you look forward to the hellscape that will become the planet Earth. And
Mad Max was cool, but I don't want to live there.
What about the planet Dune or Arrakis?
I could feel that transition coming, and I was upset about it the entire time.
As well you should be, because now we're moving on to pop culture.
We're flying on.
Pop culture. All right, so we're going to get back to the main topics at hand, pop culture being one of them. And I said this before in a previous episode, but it's weird watching movies during the lockdown, because it doesn't feel like these are movies, even though they were made years ago, you know, last year or earlier this year, or maybe you're still in production. It just, there's a disconnect between what's going on in the world right now and how abnormal things feel, and kind of the weird normalcy of seeing a big budget movie trailer, especially one like Dune. So the first Dune trailer was released by Warner Brothers earlier this week. This is from Denis Villeneuve, who directed Blade Runner 2049, as well as Arrival, and what was the other one? He's done a couple of other, as a French director, and it's the latest retelling of Dune. Now, I confess, I have not read the source material. Dune is not, that's not in my library, but that's why I got you guys on the podcast. So it sounds like
Frank Herbert is sad. Frank is so sad.
Hey, got any of that melange? You guys got any of that melange?
I think it's illegal for us to give it to you. We're not.
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
The spice. I know you're talking about the spice there. I've seen the South Park episode. That's important. Well,
did you watch the David Lynch
movie? Yes.
Okay.
So I know the plot. I know, but and I know there, you know, it's going to be another adaptation. The big elements are there. That, but what did you see in this trailer that you were excited about that was not in the David Lynch movie?
Oh, I mean, the David Lynch movie is weird. It's a David Lynch movie, and like you forget how strange it is. Like it like just think about the casting of that movie, which has Kyle MacLachlan and Sting and Patrick Stewart. It's like, it's very like when you look back on it, I'm like, how are all these people in this weird movie from like the mid 80s?
It's like Excalibur.
It's a weird movie, but it was my first time. I never read the book, and my dad was like, watch this cool sci-fi movie. And it was weird, but it was definitely cool.
Yeah. I'll just say, this looks spectacular. I'm all in. Like, every element of the trailer worked for me. Even Jason Momoa as Duncan Idaho, which is the thing I was probably the most skeptical of. From like the early pictures and stuff, I just never pictured him as Duncan in my own head. I think everyone that that has read the books and seen the David Lynch probably have their own kind of like pictures of these characters in their heads from their youth. But it just blew me away on every level. And I am one of those Timothée Chalamet haters. Like, I am not into that kid. And like I don't find him charming, but like he fills that role in a way that kind of makes sense. You know, they have to play with time in the context of this if they're going to really stay true to the original story. But what I got from the trailer, which I didn't get as much from the 1984 movie, which I haven't seen in a number of years, is Dune is kind of a bummer. Like, it's a huge bummer, the entire story.
Yeah.
Even when it reaches its conclusion, and I'm not going to spoil anything for those that don't know it, it's like not this kind of celebratory conclusion for the character that kind of comes out on top, as it were. So this is like dour in a lot of ways, and I got that mood from this movie. So it feels like it's going to be very moody and just beautiful to look at, very in a way Lawrence of Arabia, to me in its visuals.
Well, you have these elements of the hero's journey, right? And this Paul Atreides' journey of becoming who he's destined to be, but it's also both the Lynch film and also why people love the book is that it's this huge exercise in world building, and that's the thing that makes this such an outlier in kind of today's big movie budget, you know, big movie in Hollywood film, is to have a multi-hundred million dollar film be, yes, a recognizable in somewhat name for science fiction fans, for fans of 80s science fiction films. But Blade Runner 2049, even though as beloved as that story is, and as great as that movie was by the same people who made this movie, bombed. So that's why this movie feels so out of place, like why it feels like it's like how is this existing right now in the age of Marvel films?
I love that you brought up 2049, only because not just because of the parallels, there's obviously some parallels, but like that wasn't even a retelling of Blade Runner. It was a sort of continuation of the original story. And this is like, we're going to start over again with a story that isn't probably as popular as a Marvel movie, but we're going to spend the same amount of money. And like, that's kind of insane. But also, I don't know. I think your point about world building nails it. Like, that's the thing that I always loved about Dune, even when I saw the David Lynch movie first and then went and read the book, because I was like, there's so much more to this universe than they could put in that one really, really freaking weird movie. Like, you know, there the different political empires and the families that are battling. Like, it's got, if you like fantasy and sci-fi, there are elements of all of that scattered throughout this universe, literally this universe. So,
which makes for a great television show, and it makes for great long-form storytelling, which I could totally see Dune have been a HBO series, like Game of Thrones, in the way that, you know, The Witcher has done very well for Netflix. But to put all of the movies don't work that way. Right? The kind of the business of Hollywood is to high risk, high reward. If you're going to spend $100-200 million on a movie, it's got to make $1 billion worldwide.
No, see, they're going to make 20 of these movies, and then they're going to make one all together where all of the characters get together in a one or two big movies.
Share universe.
So this feels like Fury Road to me in a lot of ways, in the sense that it runs a knife's edge between it could be spectacularly awful, or it can be a legendary movie. Which I think, like, Fury Road hit it out of the park. I think it, in a lot of ways, I think Fury Road is the best Mad Max film. And this could easily be that. I don't think it's going to be, like, mediocre. We're not going to be like, that was an okay Dune movie. You're going to love this or hate it. And that's it.
That's scary. You're that kind of polarizing, you know, a movie that satisfies a hardcore film and science fiction fan, which is ostensibly why they hired Denis Villeneuve to do this, because of all the kind of success and expertise he had in making Blade Runner and Arrival, and the critical success for Arrival. That is not, I mean, this movie is on the shoulders of, honestly, of Timmy Chalamet and Zendaya being people who are going to get the actors and the star power that are going to get young people into the theaters. They have us. They have us old fogies, right? They have us science fiction fans. We got our money. But we're not going to make them $1 billion. It's going to be the kids, and the kids like Zendaya, the kids like Timmy.
So the question I have is, how long is this movie? Like, if you're making like a faithful Dune movie, it's 6 hours long, right? If you're making like a reasonable kind of outrageous Dune movie, it's still like 3 hours long. So like, how is this actually going to be a 2-hour Dune movie? They have a lot of ground to cover quickly.
It's the first half. So this is written as only covering the first half of the novel. And while the second film hasn't been greenlit for budgetary reasons, the hope and all the actors are signed for making a sequel. So this is definitely...
Spoiler, they don't need to have some of them back.
So it's going to be, like they say, a standalone epic. They need to say that because people are scared of having to invest time and energy into a story that they might not see a conclusion to, but they're hopefully there will be a sequel.
I always worry about the people that will skip the first one when they know there's a sequel. I mean, like, my uncle saw the first Lord of the Rings and was like, wait, there's more of these? And I was like, wait, dude, they've been talking about this forever. And so it's like, if people now know that this is only the first half, I wonder if there are people that will hold off so they can binge them both.
I literally did not know it was the first half. Are they still making the series, the companion series for HBO Max?
I think they're making still a prequel series. So much like, you know, this is all under the same umbrella, Warner Max, where like the Batman, the Robert Pattinson, Matt Reeves Batman, they're doing a tie-in TV series on HBO for the Gotham City Police Department, another cop show. And for this, they're doing a prequel series for HBO Max as well. Hmm. Yeah. What we don't know, what's less certain, is that the release date for this film, now that we've seen the first trailer, now they're hedging their bets. I think it had a December release date, but that may get pushed into early next year or sometime next year, because it looks like Wonder Woman 1984, which is already pushed to October, is now possibly getting pushed to December. Basically, Warner Brothers dipped their toes back into the market with Tenet, which had all the hallmarks of being a great movie to return to theaters for, except that it's not time to return to theaters. And while that movie is released overseas internationally and in many parts of the United States, except for big cities in which you can't have theater gatherings, it is falling much short of the expectations, at least set by their original budget and marketing for this film, for a Christopher Nolan film, notwithstanding the reviews and the critical reception.
I was listening to the radio and they were saying that they consider it a success even with its low budget, low kind of take so far, because of the time that it's happened in. So I think that's good to hear. I still want to see this movie and I miss seeing movies in theaters, but...
And I think that it's what will probably change, and obviously the business models have changed a lot with companies like Disney putting their big budget films like Hamilton on their subscription services, or Mulan, which we'll talk about, on their subscription services for a fee. The outside of the kind of films where you're talking about a Marvel film, where people are kind of trained to watch it that opening weekend because that is going to be the zeitgeist. It's going to be your virtual water cooler talk. Films like Tenet, while it's shrouded in mystery and there are probably spoilers out there, may have longer legs. There will be opportunities in maybe not next year, but maybe in many years to come for it to actually be back in theaters. So we can look back and say, hey, these are a bunch of films I didn't get the chance to watch in 2020 and 2021, but I would love to be able to see it in theaters if it was in theaters for a weekend, for a couple weeks in 2022.
I mean, if you think of the graph of filmmaking, right? There, you know, Hollywood makes 100 and some movies a year. They probably are going to make fewer this year. So maybe we'll see resurgences of, like, they'll double up on the movies that came out this year because they were made before, and they'll see them in the theaters when that dip would have hit theaters in a year or two, right? Yeah. Because there'll be that lag time of post-production. And I mean, that's, I'm hoping, I guess.
In other pop culture news, big news in the world of The Walking Dead, which I guess is still going on.
Is that still going?
I think it's 11 seasons, I want to say.
Wow. I would have thought 30 at this point. I feel like it's
sure feels like it. But they have announced that it will conclude at its 12th season, a two-year split in half, 12th season. But fear not, fans of those characters, if you're a fan of Daryl or Carol, I guess, who are both, by my count, still alive, they're going to have their own spinoff show. So they've already pre-announced the spinoff show. And so it really sounds like the universe will continue, which we knew was going to happen with AMC. It's too much of a moneymaker for them, but all the contracts will probably get renewed. And so this feels more like a business decision. So to get out of having to pay certain actors a lot of money because they've been on certain shows for a certain number of time. That's what it feels like to me.
It's like they've come back to life.
Now they're dead the whole time. They are the walking. We're the Walking Dead, really, for having to endure the show for so long. Okay, here's where, let's get to the fun part. Trace, have you been watching Star Trek Lower Decks?
I have not been watching Star Trek Lower Decks. I know.
Oh my God. Okay.
Okay. So wait, but my fiance and I have been watching The Next Generation in preparation of going to watch the Lower Decks, so that she knows the world. Since we're at home all the time and we only have one TV, we have to watch it on this. I have to watch it with her in the room, and she needs to know who all these people are.
Now, Kishore, I don't know if you and I have had a chance to talk about this. Jeremy and I, for sure. He also, like you, Trace, did a whole binge of Next Generation with family, and they sought more. We watched, you know, Picard together, mixed reactions to that. He did not like Lower Decks. Sure, I believe you also are not a fan.
I got through the first episode and it didn't hook me, so I didn't go back for more.
Really?
Oh, gotta stick with it.
Yeah, I hear you. Like a lot of people I respect, a lot of people I know that work in Star Trek love it and really express a fondness that it captures an element of the Star Trek universe that's been missing from some of the other shows. I don't know what to say. It didn't hook me.
It is so full of Elkars.
I always give a show at least three episodes. You only gave it one, and you're like, Norm?
What is that?
Is that like an iPad holder? What is that?
A random Elkars display.
This is Picard's computer. If you're watching the video, this was a gift from an industrial designer who worked on this as a product for the Roddenberry company. And there are not many of these in the world, but I received this recently. And it's
beautiful.
Amazingly put together replica of Picard's desktop computer.
So do you ever just sit in your office and then wait for Danica to come in and you're just staring at it and then you hit the button and then look up and acknowledge her?
Come.
Just to, you know, get the full ready room effect.
I love that.
And then stand up and ask for the Earl Grey.
I was going to say, she probably would have to bring the Earl Grey, though.
Yes.
Good luck with that.
You have a hot plate, just a hot plate of boiling water in the corner.
The 3D printer bed warming up.
Just ready, just ready.
Cookies. Exactly, exactly. I'm such a fan of Lower Decks. I know there was debates whether how canonical it is. But it very clearly, the writers, the production designers are such big Star Trek fans that there are so many little Easter eggs here and there. So I think someone described it as you can watch it as if this was a show that was played in the Star Trek universe in 24th century, like someone on Earth in 2380 watching their version of The Office. This would be that. And if you watch with that lens, you might enjoy more.
I like that. I'm excited to watch it. Like, I've heard a lot of buzz about it. And just like you, I've heard some things are good. Some people think it's fine. I skipped the Orville, although I heard that I shouldn't have. I heard that was quite fun. But I'm excited for Lower Decks. I don't know.
There's a good intersection of the tone between the Orville also being a huge love letter to 90s era science fiction, episodics. Science fiction like Star Trek and Babylon 5, and this 100% has that. I think, you know, they're wacky characters. It's a comedy for sure. It's animated. They can do all sorts of crazy things that you never see portrayed with live actors, but the spirit of it, I think, is still very, very Star Trek.
That's good. That makes me happy.
All right, and then finally, in the pop culture world, we did have the release of Mulan last week. Now, I know, Trace, not only have you not seen it yet, but you don't know if you should.
Yeah, I don't know if I should. With all of the news of Disney working with parts of China that have been known to have concentration camps in them, and you know, about some of the political, it's all the politics. I sometimes want to shut all that out and just enjoy a piece of good storytelling and art. But sometimes it can be hard, and this one hit me with a lot of that politics all at once. So now I'm conflicted.
It absolutely is complicated, and I think where I land on that is absolutely spreading the awareness of that is good. But I also am wanting to support the representation that this character means, and also the filmmakers who worked on it, who had no say in those politics, and the work that they put in putting this piece of story together. And without going to spoilers, we're not going to review the film. The one thing I will say is, even watching at home, and I have as close to, you know, the high end home, you know, 1% theater experience outside of having a theater room, dedicated room in my house with a projector as I could have. And it still, I think, fell much short of what, I'm used to it in going to a theater and watching it in a Dolby Cinema.
Like, emotional experience isn't quite there.
This movie was meant to be seen in a theater, period. Yeah. End of sentence. Here's a weird take, but if this pandemic wasn't happening and this movie got released in theaters normally, I'm not sure we see as much backlash to that we've seen online, like about the Uyghurs and everything else that has come associated. I think Disney, with their pricing model, invited more criticism for this movie and created amplification for it. And that's why I think we're hearing more about this. I think this would have been a smash hit at the theaters under different circumstances. That being said, I like this movie. There's elements that don't work for me, but it's a beautiful movie. It is very much in the epic Chinese cinema landscape. They have so much of their casting calls forth great actors from Kung Fu cinema, whether it's like Donnie Yen, Jet Li is in this movie. I don't think they use them to their to their potential. And I think this movie is missing, even amidst its incredible beauty and landscapes. And I think it's actually well acted, by, especially by the Mulan character, really carries an exceptional performance. They're missing notes from the animated movie of humor, of lightheartedness. I think not having the songs did a ton of storytelling in that movie that never quite land here. Like we get some of her motivation, but it's just very fast.
You want a reflection.
I do want that reflection moment of really getting there. And then there's a whole supernatural element to this movie that is just sort of, you know, glossed over. It's never kind of explained. And so I feel like this needed like an extra 20, 30 minutes to make it make sense.
It's, you know what, I echo most of your sentiments, especially with the casting and the underutilization of some of the actors. But there are many hat tips they gave to famous actors in Chinese cinema. Peng Che-Che, who's Cheng Pei-Pei, who's she was Jade Fox in Crouching Tiger. She played the matchmaker, which is a completely different role, but also just like a cameo role. I think I wanted this to be more Crouching Tiger than it was, and that's why I left wanting more from it, because it ended up still feeling like a Disney film, even though it is the least Disney of the Disney live action films in terms of adaptations.
I'm excited. I think I'm glad you mentioned like representation. And I think this is a movie that's one of the things I was most excited about, is like seeing live action characters play. Of all the animated movies that they made into real people movies, this is a real people movie. I wanted to see it with real people in it and see how they could like take these characters further. So I will likely still see the movie, but I was so excited for it from the moment they announced it. So I'll take your reviews and
I mean, the closest live action adaptation from Disney, their archive, is Aladdin for this. And Aladdin took a lot of liberty.
This is better than Aladdin.
And this is better in that you could actually call this an epic story. Yeah. It's a war story. And Aladdin was still very much that same story, almost like the Broadway musical was, you know, with the music. And this, I think, not having the songs, very deliberate choice, but you also lose the impact of, in the animation, the animated film, you know, of the music being a big part of the first half. And then once they reach the camp and all the soldiers, all the, you know, they see all the death, there's no music afterward. The movie gets serious. And that contrast, I think, helps the storytelling in the animation. And also the animation was fantastic. There was that, you know, that avalanche scene where for hand-drawn animation, you have this basically computer controlled cameras, animated scene where you go across this mountainscape with snow and the horses running down. And that was so groundbreaking for an animated film, that perspective and that level of complexity. And I don't think you get that, the equivalent of that here, even though the fight choreography is quite beautiful.
I'm still excited.
Yeah. You know, and if you have Disney Plus, you can just wait till the end. You don't want to pay that $30. Wait till the end of the year. Wait 3 months, and it'll be available for everyone. Before we continue with this week's episode, I want to let you know that This Is Only a Test is also made possible with support from Keeps. As guys, so much of our identity is wrapped up in our hair. When we get into our 20s and our 30s, to be honest, and start noticing the first signs of hair loss, it feels like panic time. Thankfully, there's now Keeps, the simple and easy way to keep your hair. With Keeps, you can visit a doctor online and get hair loss medication delivered right to your home. They make it easy and deliver your medication every 3 months so you can say goodbye to pharmacy lines and awkward doctor visits. Keeps offers generic versions of the only two FDA-approved hair loss products out there for a price you've never seen before. Keeps treatments typically take between 4 and 6 months to see results, so it's important to act fast. The sooner you start using Keeps, the more hair you'll save. And Keeps treatments start at just $10 a month. Plus, for a limited time, you can get your first month free. I'm at that point. My birthday was just last month, and I can barely call myself mid-30s now. And so this is one of those things where I have to keep an eye on and maybe get started on pretty soon. If you're ready to take action and prevent hair loss, go to keeps.com/onlyatest to receive your first month of treatment for free. Once again, that's keeps.com/onlyatest. Now back to the show. Okay, we'll get through this rather quickly, but big news in the world of video game consoles. Microsoft made the first move in this game of chicken, this delicate game of checkers, chess, whatever you want to call it, between Sony and Microsoft, and they flexed their market cap power. This $1 trillion company said, you know, someone high up, Satya said, hey, Panos, let's price it at 300. And let's see what Sony says. We're worth it. We got the market cap right now. We can take it. And so while the news was leaked and they probably had to announce it earlier than they had wanted to, the two versions of the next Xbox have been announced. It's the Xbox Series S and the Xbox Series X, not to be confused with the Xbox One X and the Xbox One S. It's the Xbox Series S and X. A discless version and a disc version, the entry-level one, which apparently is still more powerful than the original Xbox One, but will not do 4K gaming at 60 FPS. That one will be $300. And the Series X, which comes out, they both come out November 10th, will be $500, which is lower than I think where most of us were expecting.
Like $100 lower. Yeah. Like not a little bit lower.
That's significant, as well as the announcements they made to their Game Pass, pairing with EA. So it comes with the Origin Pass as well. It's a pretty strong week for Microsoft. Your move, Sony.
Looking at that Series S pricing, I do not understand how they got it down to $300. I mean, because you're talking about a system, I get it's still like, you know, at the highest end, but like you could still play like 100 FPS a bunch of games on the Series S. And $300, they must be losing like $100, if not $150 per console on that thing. There's so much power in these machines. I can't see Sony matching these prices.
It's going to be about the games. And Sony, with their games announcements earlier, felt like they had a stronger lineup in the launch window of games. And both of these are tapping into very high speed storage drives. So you get very fast loading. That's going to be a hallmark of this generation. Of course, tied to the engines of the real fives of the world being optimized for this stuff. And the Series S, even though it has much less storage than the Series X, it will still use that same upgradable storage system. So you get that same benefit. And for people who don't have 4K TVs right now, who are still running on high quality 1080p systems or even 1440p monitors, the Series S might be right. And $300, I know it's insane for us to say $300 sounds cheap in relative to anything else in the world you could buy. You can buy a lot of stuff for $300. It is, we do live in a world where, you know, smartphones on the regular cost upwards of $1,200 to $1,500 or even $2,000 if you're talking about like a Samsung foldable phone.
I'm looking in the context of what the launch prices were for consoles within this framework, like the PlayStation 3, the Xbox One, they all launched at much higher price points than this 300. Like the 300 has been only utilized by like Nintendo for the most part, or going back to like early editions of these consoles. So it is relatively speaking cheap, especially like if you just tear down what's inside. It's cheap for the component costs of what's inside.
I think this is a console generation that absolutely feels, maybe for the first time, the impact of mobile gaming and the timeshare and the mindshare, that the games built into the devices that people have to have, their tablets and their phones, and people being less interested maybe in the mainstream, not talking about core gamers, mainstream audiences are maybe less interested in buying a game console these days. You know, you That's don't need it for apps. You don't need it for Blu-ray. You have streaming services built into your TVs, and you have Fortnite on your phones. Maybe not their iPhone.
Not all of but them.
Most of your phones. And that's why they got to be aggressive, because they want to get you subscribed, right? They'll make that money back on a subscription plan.
That's what I was thinking with this is like, one, first thing I thought is whoever named these assumes everyone has perfect diction. And that I think is tough. But I think the thing is, I think one, it's very affordable. Maybe they're trying to get into the Switch market and be like, oh, they did so well. Maybe we can also do so well. Perhaps it's because the game systems that we all know, similar to what you said earlier, we're like older now, and we have grown as the games community has also grown. And now it's changed. Maybe the Zoomer generation doesn't care as much about consoles as the millennials did. You know, I mean, this is when they're going to have to start dealing with Zoomers being adult purchases, not teen purchases.
And so they maybe need that's to, part of it. They need to reach that critical mark where the platforms that the people are on reach a critical mass so that you get the network effects, the benefits. Because if you think about generations ago, the social networks of the world were through the game consoles. That's where people found their communities, through the Xbox, through the PlayStation. Now it's all on your phone. It's all on your PC. Discord is native, not to those devices. And that's where the people are. And you know, that's why I'm sure Microsoft is interested in also buying TikTok.
Yeah. It's platform agnostics.
Yep. In the world of phones, though, well, maybe not phones, but at least smartwatches and maybe tablets, Apple has announced they're having an event next week, September 15th. What is that? Next Tuesday, I believe.
Usually a Tuesday. Tuesday.
So they're doing this, of course, as a live stream. This will be their second big keynote just done virtually after WWDC. And the expectation is that it'll be the Series 6 watch, as well as a redesigned iPad Air, more in line with the design of the iPad Pros. Very big fan of that. And maybe even a new HomePod. Who cares about that? But also the expectation is no new iPhones at this event, and that will be announced maybe in October. So the first September event in a while with no new iPhones, which they had telegraphed with at the last earnings call. But are people excited for new iPhones?
Is it sad that the thing I'm most excited about is watching them do the filmography of, like, because WWDC was so beautifully, like, the keynote was beautiful, and they had all these, like, cool locations, and I was like, what camera are they using? I know, I know. It's like, that's the thing I'm going to be most excited to see what they do.
It was better because we didn't have that awkward, like, journalist clapping for you know, moments, right? It was great.
And that was probably already filmed, you know, maybe weeks ago for if they're planning on releasing this video next Tuesday. But imagine if they had timed the production days, you know, this past week or yesterday, right? One of the if you work in a big glass donut, you can't get away from the Mad Max sun when you're doing your filming.
Yeah.
Or lean into it and use some of that amplifying message power.
Just color correct. White balance everything weirdly. Everybody will look really weird, but it'll be the right color.
Look how fast the exposure changes and the color white balance changes with our new iPhone sensors. Phone sees the world normally, even though your eyes may not.
Oh, here come the Apple glasses. You don't want it to be orange anymore? Put this on your face.
Rosy tinted or not. They definitely see the world from their perspective. And from their perspective, Epic is the villain, not Apple. They're still ongoing with their litigation. And most recently, Apple has removed Epic's ability to do sign-in with Apple, taking away features because, from their perspective, Fortnite's having their own payment system is theft. So no resolution yet. These are two big companies, one massively bigger than the other, but still two very, very rich companies fighting at it for this, basically fighting over that 30% that Apple started establishing way back with the beginning of the App Store.
Do you see this as petty? I'm starting to see it like getting into that territory, and they show no signs of slowing down the kind of ugliness. Like, I think we're a week away from literally like Tim Cook NPCs showing up inside of Fortnite so like you can shoot them or something. It's like it is going down a weird path that is only going to get settled when Epic blinks, because you know Apple's not going to blink on this, or the lawsuits progress.
I agree.
Do you think any of it will be mentioned next week?
No.
Don't give them that publicity.
Yeah, if you're Apple, why acknowledge it?
Yeah,
it's like they be the might, elephant in the room.
The question is whether they take a subtle shot at Fortnite by featuring, you know, an FPS in some like a different one. Are they like, are we going to see like Valorant or you know, like or something you know up there as a subtle shot? I doubt it. I think Apple's like too kind of you know above the fray to do that kind of stuff. But that would signal that there's something has gotten under their skin about this, or they're worried about it. I just don't think we're going to see anything from Apple.
So much trauma in the tech world, whether it's between Microsoft and Sony, anxious to launch their consoles, whether it's between Apple, Google, and their Android 11 release, but you also have Nintendo just sitting happy in the corner, selling Switches, letting people build Lego, build Mario Lego, build an NES Lego set, and then also very soon, come October, drive a little Mario Kart around their house with an augmented reality system built in. You guys see this?
I'm so excited. I want to do this so badly. It looks so fun. It looks so fun.
It does. It does. I'm shaking my head because I'm mad because it looks so good.
It does.
This is Mario Kart Home Circuit, and it's a $100 toy that you basically in the shape of Mario or Luigi in a cart, Mario Kart style, you drive it around your house, but it has a little camera that pops up behind the seat. And the camera then beams the visual information to your Switch that gives you a live camera view, but then you also get AR elements. You know, you can disable other cars, you drive along your track, and you get power-ups. And you know, it's all we've seen so far is that promo video, and it's composited video and graphics. So we have no idea how this will actually perform. But if anyone can do it smoothly, Nintendo, I believe, can do it.
The one question I have is distance for this.
Yeah.
Because that's a huge limiting factor with most RC, you know, controlled cars. The Switch, I don't think was designed with antennas as big as most RC systems. So can this operate past 10 feet? I don't know. That's going to be a huge limiting factor.
I wonder if the car connects to your home Wi-Fi and they're just hoping that your home Wi-Fi is strong enough or something like that.
Oh, that would be so much latency then.
Yeah. There would be huge latency, but yeah. maybe that's why they're doing composited video, because they're still trying to figure out how, like maybe the video itself won't be particularly high res or something like that. You know, I mean, it just depends what their market is. If they're going for children who don't necessarily have that nostalgia of Mario Kart, they just kind of want to play Mario Kart. Either way, parents are going to hate this, because there's going to be a tiny car like shooting around under their feet everywhere.
Yeah. I think parents are going to hate this because with any latency, you're going to get so many red shell problems at the finish line, and you're going to see broken Switches and people hurling them across the...
The last thing a parent wants to do is be tech support for their kids' RC toys, right? Did you try resetting it? Have you tried updating the firmware? No?
Okay, I'll reboot the router, but after this meeting, after this meeting.
Also, $100 per cart is pretty heavy. That's you only get one. And so, you know, if you want to play this with a bunch of other kids, it gets pretty steep pretty quickly. And I guess that's what they're banking on. That's the third of a cost of a next-gen console. So it's not cheap, even for a physical accessory like a cart. All right, that does it for our tech news section. We're going to have our last section. We're skipping VR this week because Facebook Connect is next week, and we're going to save all discussion for the announcements that come from that and also from when Jeremy's back on. But I do want to get into some science, and I'm stalling right now because I need to cue the music. But here we go.
It's time for a moment of science.
So I wasn't on the show last week, so we didn't have a chance to talk about Elon Musk planting chips in the brains of pigs. So I think it's time to chat about Neuralink. And actually, I think it's better that we waited because we, like, it's always tough to comment about a demo that happens right then, especially a demo that drops like Friday afternoon. I thought that was a weird choice in terms of timing. Why don't I talk about the basics and then Trace, we can actually talk through it. So yeah. What he demoed was a very small electrode that it was essentially a chip with these very thin wires on them and a surgical system that was able to implant that into the brains of pigs. And he showed three pigs, one that never had the device installed, one that had the device installed and then removed, and one that actively had the device in it. And it was able to be controlled wirelessly and record certain signals from the pig's brain wirelessly to a system across the room. And then there were some extraordinary claims made about what you could do with that technology ongoing. So I'll just stop there. That was the bulk of what the demo was. Trace, what was your reaction?
I didn't watch the demo because I didn't want to be like, exactly what you said about extraordinary claims. There's a lot. I just did a series on my channel about BCIs. I talked to three different neuroscientists and like neuroengineers who do BCI research. Only one of the three mentioned Neuralink, and they mentioned it as a good source of funding for BCI projects. Because, you know, Neuralink is similar to, I think, Elon Musk's other pet projects and other companies, is they have a lot of market pressure. Right? They get, like, SpaceX has made space technology companies probably more money by existing than by, like, through competition. It's maybe been better for all of the space companies. Tesla is making more EVs appear in the world in a variety, and if not just electric, but plug-in electric. Neuralink is probably going to do the same for the BCI world, but BCIs, brain computer interfaces, or BMIs, brain machine interfaces, are still so, like, there's so much that we don't know about how things work. It's insane.
On the flip side of that, I also want to acknowledge, like, what he showed is technology that already exists, which is what Elon Musk has done with other companies he runs, but he's made it inside of a wrapper, inside of certain interfaces, inside of certain designs that make it more interesting. So the idea mm-hmm. of implanting a chip in a brain to record signals in real time has existed in neuroscience labs for a long time now, for years. There's so many papers you can read about recording signals. I think the difference here that we saw was he miniaturized that. There's more wireless technology associated to this than you would see in most academic labs that do this kind of work, but there are some wireless interfaces in academic labs. But I think the real advance, the miniaturization is nothing to, you know, to ignore.
Yeah.
But that surgical device, which is the thing I want to know more about, because it potentially makes like the installation of these devices much simpler, much lower cost.
Yeah.
To what is a very laborious process. Yeah.
Yeah. Right now, right now, to get a BCI into somebody's brain, I highlighted Jan Schurman, who, she became a quadriplegic as an adult. So had a lot of like the brain structures required to control her own arms and legs prior to losing them because of a disorder she developed. She could control two different robotic arms that she named Hector and Lecter. This was maybe 10 years ago. And she could control them with one set of electrodes through one implant. But the implant was constantly like, they were constantly worried about it. And that's the biggest thing about any BCI, is the human body does not like having a computer connected to its brain. Like, it will develop scar tissue. Things move around all the time. Like, the brain moves around in the skull. Like, and so they were constantly monitoring it. And that's what ended up ending her kind of BCI journey, is skin started to pull back from her implant and they had to completely remove it immediately. And end her experiment after quite a while of her being able to do this stuff. So this implantation could be, if it minimizes potentials for infection, they don't have to cut out part of your skull in the same way. Like, if there are things that you can, that they can do, that's, I don't know, cleaner almost, I guess. simpler.
You gotta wonder what the, I mean, we understand why they need to have it be safe and efficient and streamlined to start to get to a critical mass where you get the benefits of the data that you get so that you actually do interesting things later, because we're not going to get that point until you have this in a bunch of people. And that's what he's pitching right now, the path to get to that. Mm-hmm. But nothing about it compelled me from perspective of like why we would want this from a user perspective today. The whole kind of implanted Fitbit aspect of it. No,
not from a human perspective. From an animal perspective, having these in for an extended period of time is interesting. Like, there's a lot we can learn. But I think some of the leaps made about like what some of these neuron signals that he demonstrated mean is a leap. Like, we do not know that.
Yeah.
And but the idea of like miniature low cost devices that could be used by a lot of different people, as Trey said, like, the lowering of cost, that could actually be a big deal. I think there's a lot of neural engineers that are excited about that kind of element of that that market pressure coming to bear. But like, we're not getting this in. No human's getting this in. Like, I know he talked about like the breakthrough classification that the FDA gave him to develop this. No human's getting this installed anytime soon.
I feel like we'll be flying on SpaceX ships before we get something that's a practical application of this technology. This is a little more of a reach than he normally does. Like, EVs were a very short, like, they were barely a reach. They already existed, and he just packaged them nicely, like Norm said. And, you know, the SpaceX was something that existed that he packaged in a cooler way. And this is something that's a little more, I don't know, it's a little more abstract, to not to use the wrong brain pun. But, like, it's something where people aren't necessarily going to get a practical application of a lot of neuroscience for a long time. It's still a young field, even.
So up until he started using words like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and all that kind of stuff, I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. And like when he showed off like, the surgical machine and some of the other ones, I was just like, cool, like awesome. This is really weird, like very futuristic kind of tech we're seeing. If you just stopped at that part of the presentation, I would have been so on board. I think there's a lot of skepticism and appropriate skepticism from the neuroscience community because there hasn't been much information published yet about it. So we don't know much about like power, signal, like, you know, all of those like kind of details. Yeah. There's no paper out.
Neurons are very small. Very small. So like even small electrodes are going to pick up signals from lots of different neurons. And like, how many neurons are they recording? Is it safe in every part of the brain, or can we only put them in certain parts of the brain? Like, there's a lot to know still, but it's super cool.
So not skepticism that this, like what he showed off was fake in any way, but just skepticism like he hasn't released all the information yet.
Yeah. Need more info.
We always need more info. Could always use more info. Would you like to know more?
As I say on my channel, more research is needed. Just across the board.
All right. Well, we've reached that point of the show where, Trace, let us know more about your channel, where people can find more information.
Sure, yeah. You can come find science videos. I do at least one series a month. Each series is between 3 and 5 videos, so you'll get a lot of stuff in a really compact space. I release them over about a week, so you can learn a lot. I usually try and interview people. I highly recommend, since we were just talking about Neuralink, the brain engineer one. Charlene Lethal and Jessica were all amazing neuroengineers from across the country who talked to me for that. And you can find it at youtube.com/TraceDominguez or Trace Dominguez anywhere on the internet.
Awesome. We'll include links, of course, in all the places where the podcast is posted, in the YouTube description as well. Sure, anything you want to give a shout out to this week?
I'm up to my usual shenanigans, but I think it's September 23rd for the Commonwealth Club. I'm talking to Michael Ian Black from the state and like Estella and, you know, a million different things. He has a book out about fatherhood. His son is going off to college, and he has a lot of reflections on that experience. So I'm excited about that.
Very cool. Awesome. And of course, next week, We'll be following Connect and announcements hopefully coming out of there. And Jeremy will be back for that discussion afterward. Thank you so much, Trace, for joining us this week. Thank you all out there for listening. Thank you, folks, who are creating new intro pieces for us. If you want to create one, always happy to accept them. We'll put them into our queue. We'll play them in a future episode. You can always just Twitter DM them to me, upload a SoundCloud file, or email them to me, norman@tested.com. Same with our outros. This outro, this most recent one, is created by user Great Job. As always, I've not listened to it, so let's enjoy it for the very first time together.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
Tested.
Hell, I'm going to the beach where I belong. Where the days are warm and the nights are long.
Boardwalk discount coupons at Long's Drugstores.
Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk.
In the warm California sun.
Boardwalk.
I don't know what that is. That's great. You guys do that all you want.
That was fantastic. Well done. Great job. Great job. And if you don't know what that is, look it up. The Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk. One day we'll be able to go back.
Boardwalk.
Boardwalk. All right. See you guys next week. Thanks, Trace. Thanks, Kishore. Bye.